From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is Apple facing the music? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. After weeks of reports about substandard working conditions at suppliers in China, Apple has initiated an independent audit of 90% of the factories. Inspections reportedly began today, and they'll include two units of Foxconn, where iPads and iPhones are made. In the U.S., protesters admit they still use Apple products. Will the audit provide reassurance that the company is doing right at the same time it's doing well? Why is Apple being singled out when many other American tech companies use the same suppliers? A reporter's notebook later on, two car bombs aimed at Israelis in two foreign capitals. Who's to blame? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Apple stock reached an all-time high of more than $500 a share this morning as Apple announced an independent audit of working conditions at Chinese subcontractors. How bad are they? Do consumers care enough to change their buying habits? On Reporter's Notebook, Israel is blaming Iran and Hezbollah for a car bomb that exploded in India and another that was defused in Tbilisi in Georgia. We'll hear more as tensions rise in the Middle East. First, this news update. President Obama released his latest budget today, a familiar document framed with familiar rhetoric.
We got a choice. We can settle for a country where a few people do really, really well and everybody else struggles to get by. Or we can restore an economy where everybody gets a fair shot, everybody does their fair share, everybody plays by the same set of rules from Washington to Wall Street to Main Street. That's the America we believe in.
Major Garrett is congressional correspondent for the National Journal. Always good to have you on our program.
Warren, great to be with you. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. You're reporting that Obama knows his budget is dead on arrival because he suspects it was dead before it was even conceived. what are its chances?
Well, sometimes I have a turn of phrase that is somewhat and mildly memorable. What I mean by that is the president learned last year that the divide between his administration and his Democratic allies in the Senate and House Republicans is so vast, so great, so profound, so philosophically rooted that his budget is not going to meet with approval in the House. And if it doesn't meet approval there, then it's not going to be a unified budget and something that is really a document for the entire country to build off of. That doesn't mean some of the things the president has proposed are irrelevant. One thing that's worth noting is this is the first budget written after the Budget Control Act was passed during that whole ugly, unseemly summertime standoff over raising the debt ceiling. And what that did, one thing that's important, is it set hard and fast spending limits on the discretionary side of the budget. And the president's own budget reflects those hard caps and choices beneath those. Whether Republicans and Democrats follow those, we have yet to know. But the president respects those limits and has spent a good deal of time explaining what he wants to increase, what he wants to cut, and why. And that reflects at least some meeting of the minds on keeping at least one part of the budget somewhat under control.
One of the things he's not doing is much in the way of entitlement reform, which pretty much means cutting particularly in Medicare and Medicaid,
That's right.
To some extent in Social Security. You say the GOP this year lacks the passion for this fight and lacks some of the fortitude necessary for the politically risky follow-through, which, of course, is actually making cuts.
Exactly. What everyone learned in the country last year is that Paul Ryan, the Budget Committee Chairman, Wisconsin Republican, rising star in that party, put together a budget that everyone in the House and everyone in the Senate who was a Republican voted for. And yet, one thing it's worth pointing out in Washington, a budget is just a platform document. It's a blueprint. It doesn't have any actual legislative heft unless you write the laws underneath it to make it real. And what happened after Paul Ryan's budget got all those Republican votes, all those energetic House Republicans had ample opportunity, Warren, to write exact legislation to put that into effect, and they never did, and they're not going to this year. That's what I speak to when I speak to the fortitude issue. The president watched Republicans behaviorally. Yes, they voted for it as a blueprint, but they didn't vote for it as a legislative vehicle. Now, if Paul Ryan went on the phone, he would say, why should I do that, Warren? Because all I'm going to do is get hammered by Senate Democrats. That's true. But oftentimes in politics, that's how you win an argument. You demonstrate your political belief in something, and you keep moving it again and again. Republicans moved it once, and they haven't touched it since.
So what are the prospects, then, for the major spending programs of the United States government for the year being proposed by the president and the politics that it represents?
Really, we're going to see a status quo sort of arrangement this year with a lot less histrionics and a lot less fulminations, at least rhetorically. Republicans don't have the fight on the budget. They want to settle this in the 2012 election. One thing they learned is talking about debt and deficits tends to expose at least as much the divisions in their own ranks, because Republicans are divided on the order of magnitude in which they want to cut. They can't agree on that. Some are more cautious than others. And for the president, he's got the Budget Control Act. He's not going to attack entitlement reform, at least in a structural sense. He's going to wait until that argument is settled by the 2012 election. So if I were to point to a song that some in your audience may remember, I'm a college product of the 1980s. I graduated in 1984. I remember the song from 1981, Once in a Lifetime. I'd say Talking Heads song, the most important lyric, same as it ever was. So for the budget this year, we are at a position of same as it ever was.
And you don't think then there will be the same kind of rhetorical disputes and threats to shut down the government and all that kind of thing going on this year?
No, there won't. The shutdown of the government last year was a byproduct of the inability of the Democrats to pass a budget in 2010. The budget's been passed for 2012. It's done. This one's proposed for 2013. It'll go through the regular process. They have a top-line number. The appropriators proved last year, meaning the people who put the spending priorities together, that they could handle that. They'll handle it again this year. There's no debt ceiling crisis to deal with. Most people are going to be focused on the election, and I wrote 2 weeks ago at National Journal that we're going to have kind of a Rachel Carson silent spring on the whole budget. It's going to be numbers for a day or two, and then it's going to fall right off the front pages, and both parties will be content with that.
All right. We will hold you to that prediction, Major Garrett. It's always good to have you with us, congressional correspondent for the National Journal. In a moment, is Apple facing the music? On To the Point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Last year, it was Wired magazine reporting on allegedly inhumane working conditions at Foxconn, which makes iPads and iPhones for Apple at two factories in China. But it was two stories last month in the New York Times and a broadcast on public radio's This American Life that apparently led 250,000 customers to turn in complaints last week to the world's most valuable company. Today, Apple announced that the Fair Labor Association has already begun independent inspections of Chinese factories that make 90% of its product. Larry Dignan is reporting the story for as editor-in-chief of ZDNet. That's an online publication that covers business technology. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
Tell us a bit more about what Apple has announced, and have the inspections already begun?
Yeah, they've begun today. Apple announced that the Fair Labor Association is going to audit their Foxconn factories in China. They're also going to look at two other companies that also make basically the majority of Apple's products in China. And I think the wild card here is just, you know, whether this gets people off Apple's back or whether, you know, these third-party things have teeth as far as auditing goes.
Interesting that today on the New York Stock Exchange, Apple's stock reached an all-time high of more than $500.
Right. I see those things are as largely unrelated. I think people are looking at the iPad 3 coming up and, you know, the product cycle and those sort of things to drive the stock.
So, in other words, it hasn't hurt the value of the company that people are complaining, bringing petitions around and concerned about worker health and safety in China.
I don't think so. I mean, there's a broader tech issue here. You know, I mean, when you think about it, there's a broader manufacturing issue. When I looked up the companies that make up the Fair Labor Association, there's really a lot of apparel companies: Adidas, Puma, New Balance, Nike. And a bunch of others. So the actual Fair Labor Association is basically comprised of mostly non-tech companies. And it just highlights that China is basically our supply chain, right? It's our manufacturing floor for America.
And how does that then fit into the dispute about Apple in particular? Are you saying that it's being singled out unfairly?
I don't know if it's unfairly, but they're clearly being singled out because they're the big dog, right? I mean, you look at what Foxconn makes. They make TVs, they make handsets, they make networking gear, they make the iPhone and iPad, obviously, but they also make notebooks. HP is the second largest customer they have, based on research I've seen. So, you know, it's not like it's just Apple in these plants. You could go through any tech company, whether it's your data center, whether it's your cell phone. I mean, just anything you have running around in your house, right, may have gone through these factories. So Apple's being pointed out because it's a highly valuable company, and it's the big, you know, it makes for a nice target. So I think that's, you know, there's a broader tech issue here, and there's also a broader economic issue, just because that keeps Chinese manufacturing keeps costs down, and, you know, would people pay extra for something made in America? Not sure. I mean, we've kind of gone through that a few times and didn't seem to work.
Larry Dignan again at ZDNet. Adam Minter is based in Shanghai. He's a reporter and columnist whose outlets include Bloomberg Worldview, an opinion site at Bloomberg News. He's also reported widely on Chinese raw materials, and he has a forthcoming book, Wasted, Inside the Multi-Billion Dollar Trade in American Trash. He joins us from Shanghai. It's just past 3 a.m. there, and Adam, you're a real soldier for being on our program at this hour. Thank you very much, as always.
No, it's a pleasure.
What about this? Do you think that Apple has been, in fact, unfairly singled out? What about Foxconn? How close have you been able to get to that company to find out what's really going on there?
Well, you know, I don't want to be in the position of defending Apple, but I will say conditionally, yes, I think they have been unfairly singled out. You have to sort of look at the broader picture of what Chinese manufacturing is at this point. I mean, we tend to, as Americans, and I'm a Minnesotan, we tend to think of Chinese manufacturing as something that makes things for the United States. And it tends to be high-tech products like iPads and iPhones. But the fact of the matter is, Chinese manufacturing is largely directed towards China. There's a tremendous domestic market in China. And generally speaking, those jobs are not nearly as good as the jobs that you would get if you are working for a company that's manufacturing for the United States. And this is pretty much conventional wisdom, not just amongst managers in China, but amongst workers as well. The good jobs are not the jobs working for the Chinese steel mill or the Chinese textile dyeing company. The good jobs are the ones that are working for a company like Foxconn that needs a higher quality standard. We're not even talking a human rights standard, a higher quality standard so that they can ship their stuff to the United States. And if you're going to have a higher quality standard, generally speaking, you're going to treat your workers better than you would if you were just manufacturing for the Chinese market. And so in the hierarchy of Chinese manufacturing, you know, American and European companies are the jobs you want. Chinese companies aren't. And you sort of saw this just last week when Foxconn started its second wave of hiring for a new plant in Zhengzhou. That's in Henan province, a desperately poor province in central China. They hired 130,000 people last year, and they're ramping up with another 100,000 right now. And despite all these reports we're seeing in the press about how terrible the conditions are at Apple, there were 100,000 people who are going to be hired, and they had lines 200 meters long outside of the Zhengzhou Foxconn facility. Well, why? Well, the conditions are better, and the pay isn't bad. Now, in the New York Times stories we've been talking about, we saw one employee referred to as earning about $22 a day. Now, that may sound very small by L.A. standards, but by China standards, that's not too bad. We just had last week a very interesting study from a Hong Kong human resource company called JM Gemini, which compared starting salaries for office jobs in Shanghai, Guangzhou, and Beijing. And starting, you know, salaries as receptionists, as tellers, bank tellers, logistics shipping clerks are pretty much comparable in these big cities to those Foxconn jobs. So, you know, I think you need to keep some of that in perspective. It's not quite as simple as it's being presented there. And I think, you know, I salute the New York Times for their reporting, They've gone to these employees who've had trouble, who've been injured in accidents at these factories, but they haven't exactly gone to the people who go to these factories and work in them and line up 200 meters deep to get a job in Zhengzhou. And that's the other side of the story that needs to be told. This is far more complicated than Apple Computer and Foxconn, exploiting Chinese laborers.
Why does a higher quality standard mean better working conditions for the employees?
Well, I mean, it's real simple. I mean, you know, you're not making, say, you know, a toy where you don't need a lot of concentration. If you're going to be placing circuitry into an iPhone or an iPad, you want people to be minimally alert. You know, and you want them treated well. You want them fed well. You want them well rested. If you're abusing your workers, you're not going to get a very high quality control standard. It's just that simple. And that goes throughout manufacturing. I mean, there's no question that these 12-hour shifts are going on. And that's as much, you know, a part of worker choice as it is, Foxconn. I mean, this is the other side of the story. I mean, the people who go and work in these factories are migrants. And many of them, you know, they leave their family, they travel hundreds, if not, you know, thousands of kilometers, and they have nothing else going on. And if you go to these factories, and I haven't been in Foxconn, but I've been in Wistron, which makes the Acer brand of computers. You know, if you go into these factories, these kids have nothing else to do. They don't have family, they don't have friends. And so if you have nothing else to do, you're going to want to work that overtime. You're going to want to work that overtime shift. And it's pretty standard across South China with these factories where you'll have seven-day shifts. And a lot of these kids will take one day off a month, and that one day off a month is the day they get paid. And so they go down to the post office and wire the money home. Now, I want to be really clear. I'm not defending this stuff, but I think it's very important to keep that in perspective, you know, insofar as, you know, there's worker choice here as well as exploitation. And there's no question there's exploitation happening. You've got a far more complicated story than what's being presented, and just in the New York Times and especially in the This American Life story.
Adam Mitter, again, works for many outlets, including Bloomberg Worldview. Nancy Kane is a historian of business and the workplace at the Harvard Business School. She's currently teaching the history of leadership spanning Henry V to Mark Zuckerberg. Her latest book is The Story of American Business. Nancy Kane, good to have you on our program.
Always a pleasure.
How does all this fit into the story of American business?
Well, you know, historians like to say that history doesn't repeat itself precisely, but sometimes it does rhyme. And, you know, there are many rhymes, as Adam and Larry know, between this moment and the history of business and, you know, jobs overseas and just the basic textile industry, which has migrated, like the tech industry, to low-wage places for centuries.
Starting in Britain.
And, you know, emigrating to the United States and then to other parts of the British Empire as America industrialized and wages rose, and then to, you know, Asia and now the former Soviet bloc countries. And in each of those places, at each of those moments of mass industrial migration and worker opportunity, as Adam was talking about, in low-wage industrializing countries, there have been, you know, very, very different labor standards. What is different, and so that part is not new, and you know, Adam is surely right to point to the complexity of the Chinese, you know, labor landscape here and the opportunities that manufacturing jobs represent, particularly for American factories or for higher value-added products. What is different today, and this really does need to be noted, is a couple of things. First, this is the first time in history that we have a truly interconnected global village and therefore millions of consumers and newspaper consumers and folks using Twitter and Facebook to galvanize attention around this. And this is a not to take anything away from consumer responsibility, because the fault, dear Brutus, lies not just in manufacturing and in relative labor costs, but also in consumers' willingness to turn a blind eye to the price and human costs of their iPad. So we now have a galvanized group of consumers all over the world, and incendiary information and you know, socially motivating instruments called smartphones that are sending this stuff all around, as Phil Knight of Nike learned really, really clearly, you know, more than 10 years ago when he faced something very similar to this in terms of the conditions in his textile-producing factories in Asia. So,
and did that make a difference for Nike?
Huge difference. I mean, there's a reason why the Fair Labor Association, right, has sanctified and accredited Nike facilities. It's because Nike got into such hot water here with a whole group of girls and young women that there are women now in their 20s and 30s that will never buy Nike products because they learned when they were 14 that little kids were working in egregious accident-prone conditions making their tennis shoes and their sporting goods equipment.
All right. Now, what about the Fair Labor Association? We heard a moment ago from Larry Dignan that it's principally apparel companies. So here's Apple asking it to inspect its factories. What are we going to get out of that?
Oh, we could get lots of good stuff out of that. I mean, this is a company that, you know, this is an organization that has a lot of stakeholders, a lot of different constituents, came out of a Clinton initiative while Clinton was president, has United Nations links. You know, is it going to please all kinds of, you know, activists around global labor conditions? No. Is it a credible organization that knows something more than a little about looking at and making judgments and assessments of labor practices, conditions, and safety in different kinds of factories? You bet it does. And it's surely a sign, you know, as Larry said at the top of the hour, about, you know, where Apple is on this and what they're thinking about this, that they're calling this in terms of, you know, an good offense is the best fast defense. So I think it's important that this is happening. But again, there's one other thing that's important to think about that's brand new here, and that is that Apple is, and, you know, Adam said this, but let me just kind of hone it a little bit. Apple is not more than just a big, you know, big cheese. It's more than just the big enchilada. It's more than just the world's most valuable company by market cap. It has an extraordinarily aspirational brand that it has purposely built and created and nurtured. And that brand is all about, from Steve Jobs' early years founding the company and his, you know, few but very powerful speeches to this effect, all about human improvement, human betterment, human democracy, right, and the empowerment of information technology to follow the best angels of the human spirit. Now, that brand does not mesh with Foxconn.
Did he ever claim that he was having that he would have the best labor conditions for people who made his products?
Well, according to, you know, our erstwhile and very carefully reporting colleagues at the New York Times, he stood up in 2010 and waved the standard and said, "We're doing a really good job at this," and perhaps Apple is relative to other players, but this isn't just a relativity game anymore, and consumers and activists aren't necessarily interested in relativity.
Okay. Nancy Kane, again, a historian of business in the workplace at the Harvard Business School. We're also talking with Adam Minter in China and Larry Dignan with ZDNet. We'll come back. We'll talk a bit with Mike Daisy, who's an author and performer who's been protesting what he refers to as the agony and the ecstasy of Steve Jobs. We'll hear from all of them again as our program continues. On Reporter's Notebook, two car bombs aimed at Israelis in two foreign capitals. Who's to blame? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to the To The Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To The Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Well, we're not only back with To The Point. Once again, Apple has authorized an audit, which has already begun, of some of the controversial factories that it uses in China to manufacture iPads and iPhones and other products as well. And there, of course, has been a good deal of dispute about what working conditions are like there. Adam Minter was on our program earlier. He didn't defend what China is doing, but said that the jobs that Apple and other high-tech companies provide are probably as good as you can get in China for certain kinds of people. Mike Daisy is an author and performer. His latest show, and now at the Public Theater in New York, is The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. He was part of a broadcast we referred to earlier on This American Life, the public radio program, which helped to get people, consumers of Apple products, up in arms. And Mike Daisy, good to have you back on our program.
Good to be here.
Do you think that Apple, as Nancy Kane is suggesting, has heard the message?
Well, I think Apple is evolving its PR message. Let's remember, they actually joined the FLA almost a month ago. So the fact that they're announcing today that these inspections are happening is mostly PR spin. Like, the actual joining happened a while ago. So, you know, this suits their needs now. They've released this information on Monday morning, so we'd get into the news cycle, so we would have this discussion in the context that they would like to have it in.
Don't they need the PR spin?
Yes, they do. And I think that's what's telling about it, is when they announced they were joining the FLA, which happened a week after the This American Life piece aired, they did it on a Friday before holiday weekend to try to bury the news. But now they want people to know that they're taking action. And I think that indicates that they're realizing that what they're doing isn't working. Their last, the email from Tim Cook after the New York Times story ran, the internal email that they knew would be leaked, talked about how furious Apple was at the allegation that they don't care. And the dominant tone was fury. And I think Apple's realizing that that's not very productive, that when people hear really horrible stories about the working conditions and they get verified reports of those conditions persisting for years with active negligence, people get upset.
Why should Apple be singled out when we heard how complicated the whole economy of China is in the first place, and then also how important it is to worldwide distribution? There's a lot of factors in this.
Well, let's stick a knife in this whole complicated thing, for starters, because this isn't actually that complicated. Local China labor law forbids most of the activities that are happening. Foxconn is in violation of most of those laws per all the reporting that it happens in the New York Times, CNN, my reporting fact-checked by This American Life. So we're really talking about conditions that if they were happening in California, the principal members of those companies would be under indictment. So, you know, this idea that it's such a complex situation, I've been on the ground, I've been in the factories, I've stood and interviewed people in those lines waiting to get those jobs. I'm well aware that the rural Chinese situation is incredibly harsh and that they are doing everything they can to better their lives. They have reasons for why what they're doing. Us, on the other hand, we exported those jobs without any of the standard labor protections that we fought so hard here to have for ourselves. We made a choice to do that, and it's not conscionable. And so working to get fair labor standards so people do not work excessive overtime, so people aren't poisoned on the line, these are not crazy ideals. These are simple things that every human being deserves in their workplace.
Now, back to Nancy Kane, our historian of business in the workplace at the Harvard Business School. You talked earlier about the movement of the textile industry from England to the United States to other parts of the British Empire, and now then to Asia, and now into the former Soviet republics. When have job conditions or good conditions ever been exported along with the jobs? Isn't the whole idea to save money?
Yes, it is. The answer to that question, Warren, is when you have, you know, in some sense, enlightened or highly conscious textile owners. So you think about someone like Francis Cabot Lowell in the United States. He educated his women. He housed them well. He fed them well. He offered them faith and all kinds of self-improvement. But that was an outlier. That was an exception.
Did he sell products?
You bet. Oh, he was incredibly successful. He was the most successful textile magnate in the United States, partly because he kept turnover so low, right? Because remember, there's enormous turnover. You're churning through people, right? You're churning through people in egregious conditions. I think Mike makes a really important point that as companies, countries, and regions start to, you know, grow, incomes rise, standards rise, laws are enforced, these practices change, right? And it isn't that complicated. They change because they violate laws and the laws are enforced. And then, if that imposes more expense, it doesn't always impose nearly as much expense as we think, then often there's a shift out again of labor. But this cycle is as I said, not new. There are, however, as you know, as we talked about, other things that may change that cycle this time and change it quickly, including, right, Apple's own sense that this is dangerous for them, so they're on the PR bandwagon, as Mike pointed out.
So, Adam Minter, back to you. In China, you said you didn't want to defend Chinese practices, but you tried to explain what you referred to as the complexity of the situation. What about a company like Apple? Isn't it, with more value than any other company in the world, in a position to be an enlightened owner, such as we just heard about in the textile business?
Yeah, I mean, that's what's, I think, difficult for people who haven't spent a lot of time in China to understand. And I don't mean that in a condescending way. I've spent almost 10 years now going in and out of Chinese factories. I specialize in the recycling industry. I go in and out of Chinese scrapyards a lot. And I can tell you that on balance, the tech companies here, the foreign-owned tech companies, including companies like Foxconn, have the very best conditions. And it's kind of an uncomfortable message for a lot of people in the States who haven't had exposure to what factory conditions are like in the developing world. But the fact is that the foreign companies like Apple and like Walmart in particular have actually raised the game in China across the board. You know, if you didn't have an Apple in China, you would have a far, far worse standard within the tech industry here. That's just a fact. They've brought in first-world standards. They haven't been able to implement them entirely, but they brought them in, and things are much better than they would be had they not been here. Same goes for a company like Walmart. When they come in and they actually set up their supplier agreements, to manufacture products, they actually have labor standards. Now, every company here, I've been in, you know, hundreds of factories here. I've never been in a factory here that hasn't in some way violated some kind of labor law. Every single one does, you know, but that's China, and there is no rule of law here. It's all about relationships. But if you go against what the standard generally is for a Chinese company here and what Apple and companies like Walmart and other U.S. manufacturers are doing with even the minimal labor standards that they bring into play, you're actually seeing them pull the train along, if you will. They've actually raised the standard. And I know that's difficult to comprehend if you haven't spent a lot of time in Chinese factories. But if you talk to the sourcing managers here, if you talk to the journalists who travel to these factories that aren't just tech factories, they're going to tell you the same thing.
Let me go back to Larry Dignan, our first guest, editor-in-chief of ZDNet, the online publication covering business technology. Do you think that American consumers who are buying up iPods, iPads, and iPhones as they sign signatures, 250,000 signatures on petitions, really care enough to make an impact on Apple?
Not in aggregate. I really think that the U.S. consumer wants cheap goods. And, I mean, honestly, I mean, we've seen this in other economies where, you know, they start out as a low manufacturing base and then they move up the stack, so to speak. Like, if you look at the Indian outsource companies, they're getting into more research and development and that kind of thing. I could see a scenario in a few years where, you know, Chinese ways of living improve and then that labor might go someplace else.
So that has happened already to a certain extent, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, it's already happening in textiles and other industries.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, that seems to, you know, I always have the saying, I said eventually India is going to get India'd, right, in the tech space, because that outsourcing work just will just go someplace cheaper. And, you know, that could play out in China in a few decades, too. So I think there's this insatiable desire to get a deal, and you know, for all the folks going to Walmart or you know Apple stores or wherever, I think it's very hard to put a premium on labor conditions.
So, Mike Dazy, back to you, our author and performer doing The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, and also has been to China. Have you given up your Apple products? As I recall, the last time we spoke, you hadn't.
That's totally irrelevant to anything we're actually talking about.
Why?
Isn't
the point here to reach the consumer?
If I throw away my devices, I will not be able to interact with the world. I wouldn't even be able to have this conversation with you about reforming how the industry fundamentally works. What I'm hearing from a lot of people here is fundamentally apathy, that the economic forces will naturally align themselves. We're talking about a country that is a fascist country run by thugs, and we've chosen to put industries in that country, and then we're dealing with the ramifications of that. I've been working this story almost 2 years. I perform it night after night. I've talked to tens of thousands and now hundreds of thousands and millions of people about this. And 18 months ago, we never would have been having this discussion we're having right now. And people would have said this, even getting to this point, was absolutely impossible. I think people's sense of what change is actually possible is extremely limited.
Nancy Cain, what do you say to that?
I agree completely with Mike, and I agree completely with him. And I mean, let's just you mentioned Walmart a few minutes ago. I mean, think of how much consumer mobilization and consumer disgruntlement Walmart has faced, and what it has done in the United States to counteract that, both around its environmental policies and mostly around its labor practices. So everyday low prices is not just the only thing that consumers want. They want something else, and they want to know what kind of business, especially aspirational brands, do. And they can know now because all businesses live in glass houses. And Apple made $13 billion on $43 billion in revenue last quarter. There is no way this company can't afford to still be an extraordinarily profitable public company and play by a different set of standards on its value chain, because ultimately the question is, what kind of responsibility goes with extraordinary market leadership? And you can see when New York Times reporters quote all these Apple executives that this does not sit right with lots and lots of people, including our good selves, and for very, very good reasons.
Larry Dignan, how do you respond to that?
I just have to see the proof. When people start saying that labor practices matter to them as consumers, and they start returning iPads and MacBooks, then I'll believe. But right now, I mean, I understand the need to, you know, force change within a company. But at the end of the day, if you really want to make change, return your MacBooks.
Adam Minter, in China, are you saying that Apple is not in a position to make the kinds of changes that we're hearing it ought to? Is it?
No, I'm not saying that. But. You got to understand, I mean, this is a totally different industrial culture here. I mean, Apple has made the choice to come over and manufacture here, and they've come over for a lot of reasons. Labor is actually one of the smallest reasons. I mean, one of the things that the New York Times articles highlighted very well was that one of the reasons they came over was that they could change their factory structure very quickly, and that's just not something that's easy to do in the U.S. Nonetheless, you're dealing with an incredibly different corporate culture here, and if you're going to manufacture on a very high level, you're going to have to adapt, and it takes time. And one of the things that I was told a long time ago when I first got here, started going to factories, is that you do not develop from top down, you develop from the bottom up, and it's a matter of training managers here even what fair labor standards are. Remember, they're only 30 years into an economic development here, and you go into a factory that's not a Western managed factory, and you're going to see something very different. Apple's got 1.2 million managers here, or 1.2 million employees here, God knows how many managers, and they're going to have to actually train those people up, and it's taking time, but it's certainly getting better. This idea, though, that Mike Daisy can't, get rid of his Apple products, that consumers can't get other Apple products, is absolutely preposterous. I mean, that speaks louder than anything. I mean, use a landline instead of your iPhone. I don't see how this idea that you can't boycott, that you can have your cake and eat it too, it can stand. I mean, there is the power of the consumer here, and Apple's obviously responded to it. Walmart's responded to it. Other companies have responded to it, and the advocacy has had a result, but it just takes time. You don't develop from the top down.
So, Mike Daisy, there are alternatives maybe to Apple products.
I'm sorry, what?
There are alternatives to using Apple products. Adam Minter is saying
there aren't alternatives to products that are made in anything approaching humane standards today. That's why we need to work for reform across the industry. I don't throw away my iPhone today because I bought it before I went to Shenzhen. Instead, I'm making a sensible decision to use the devices I have now until they become obsolete and slow down the upgrade cycle. And this idea that we're defined by what we consume rather than what we actually do is kind of pathetic, frankly.
Nancy Cain, what about bringing the jobs back to the United States if, in fact, Apple has sufficient resources to make the kinds of changes you're proposing in a market so far away and so different?
You know, that's difficult, though, and it goes back to what both Adam and Larry said, and that is that the landscape in which Apple both manufactures and – you know, translates innovations into manufacturing is not so different from the industrial cluster that grew up around the automobile industry in Michigan, right? It's now a cluster full of first and second and third tier firms. So how do you bring that back? You know, it's possible you could do it, but it would be very, very difficult. But again, you know, there is no reason why why Apple, which has all the power on the supply chain, I hear what Adam says about the kind of landscape this is in China, but Apple has all the power, more power than any other manufacturer in China. So the question is, what are they going to do with all that authority?
Let me see. I guess Mike Dazy is saying very clearly that Apple is not the only player here. You, Nancy Kane, are saying that it's the biggest and has a particular leadership.
And therefore Warren, a pace car, right? It's like the rabbit running ahead of the greyhounds. It's setting standards that would effectively raise the bar, as Adam talked about in the case of American factories generally in China, and change the game. It wouldn't be that hard.
Are we not what we consume?
I put a lot of onus on consumers, and I do not think that we will wait that long for some sizable or noticeable newsworthy boycott. I think that's coming.
So, Adam Minter, how would the Chinese respond if there were such a thing?
Respond to a boycott?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, the interesting thing is that the Chinese are not calling for a boycott, and they're the ones working in these factories. And that's something that I think that's been overlooked. I mean, you know, it's no secret what the conditions are in factories across this country, and no secret that apples are better, but you don't see Chinese people, you know, boycotting Bao Steel, you know, for, you know, using, you know, poor labor conditions in the girder factories that are building high-rises here. I mean, one of the most interesting aspects of the New York Times series was to actually see some of the comments that came in from Chinese folks who read the story in Chinese. And generally speaking, a lot of those comments were, this is how you develop. And, you know, I think, you know, we can sort of be sort of American narcissists about this and talk about, you know, what we're going to do. But the fastest growing market for these products is China. And there is no objection to this in China. These people are lining up to work at these factories, you know, and I think that's probably a really good, you know, place to sort of restart the discussion is, what do the people who are actually building this stuff, how do they want to deal with it? And they're not calling for boycotts at all. They're calling for the opportunity to work in these factories.
Mike Dazy, how do you respond to that?
They're not calling for anything. They don't have a democratic country. It's an authoritarian country, incredibly locked down. And the synthesis of that authoritarianism mixed with capitalism and massive corporatism is what made the special economic zone possible in the first place. So fundamentally, this idea that people who work want to work and therefore they should be given whatever standards that are slightly better than they had in the rural areas, they should settle for this sort of race to the bottom, is exactly what's wrong with this sort of neoliberal economics. Fundamentally, we know what it is to have a humane workplace. It doesn't have to be comfortable, but it has to not kill the people who work in it or poison them or maim them, and it has to work to give them reasonable workplaces that they can thrive in. None of the reporting on these stories indicates that that's happening in any sort of way.
Nancy Kane, again, from a historical point of view, what do you think we're going to see as Apple opens its factories to inspections and apparently responds to the criticism that it's received?
I think we'll see, you know, plenty of watch-outs, plenty of mistakes, and plenty of things to correct, which Apple will, as Mike pointed out, make quite a big public, you know, spectacle and announcement around correcting. And it will remain to be seen whether, right, the game has really changed at all, or whether this is Band-Aids on a system Apple is not ready to disrupt.
All right. Well, thank you all very much for being on our program. Fascinating conversation. Nancy Kane, at the Harvard Business School, her history of leadership course, Henry V to Mark Zuckerberg, and her latest book, The Story of American Business. Adam Minter in China, thanks again for being up so early in the morning there. An upcoming book, Wasted, Inside the Multi-Billion-Dollar Trade in American Trash. Mike Dazy, now performing at the Public Theater in New York, The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. And Larry Dignan, editor-in-chief of ZDNet, an online publication covering business technology. It's very good to have all of you on our program. Car bombs aimed at Israelis in India and the nation of Georgia were the work of Iran and Hezbollah. That's according to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. We'll hear more about that, including what the evidence is, on To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @tothepoint_KCRW.
Warman Ali back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In New Delhi, a passing motorist slapped an explosive on the car carrying the wife of an Israeli diplomat. It went off, and she's been hospitalized in moderate condition. In Tbilisi, capital of the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, a driver who worked for the Israeli embassy found an explosive duct taped to hit the bottom of his car. It was defused. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is blaming Iran and Hezbollah. Joel Greenberg is Jerusalem correspondent for The Washington Post. And Joel, it's good to have you back on our program.
Good to be on the show.
These things happened nearly simultaneously. Is the prime minister offering any evidence for his accusations as to who was behind it?
Well, he hasn't offered any detailed concrete evidence, but he is pointing to a pattern. And he mentioned recent incidents in Thailand and Azerbaijan in which local authorities said they had arrested people who were plotting attacks possibly on Israelis. And the two groups, Iran and Hezbollah, have themselves voiced a desire for revenge against what they have described as Israeli attacks, killing of a nuclear scientist in Iran, and 4 years ago the assassination of a top Hezbollah operative in Damascus, Syria. So in terms of motive, it seems to Israeli analysts and many officials here, the motive is there, and Netanyahu has been connecting the dots, but again, not offering any concrete proof that Iran was, in fact, behind today's attacks.
Well, has Israel responded to the idea that there is a pattern, or has been a pattern, behind the series of assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists?
Well, Israeli officials have been silent about that, which, of course, raises even more questions. There have been some statements welcoming the death of these scientists, but Israel has given no indication that it's involved. So Israel has been very careful not to take any kind of responsibility or show any signs of responsibility for those attacks. But it's widely assumed, and the media here widely assumes, that what's going on is part of a pattern of tit-for-tat attacks that are focused on this building confrontation and the Iranian nuclear program.
So nobody says it, but everybody believes it, I take it, is what you're saying.
Well, there's been no official responsibility, and that works cuts both ways. I mean, we haven't heard any claim of responsibility for today's bombings either.
So where does this leave the relationships between Israel and these other countries, India and Georgia? I don't know if it has relations with Georgia that are important to it. It certainly does with India.
Yes, India has a significant defense mission or defense representation in India. I mean, there is cooperation between the armies and security establishments. And so this attack, which actually was aimed at an Israeli defense representative in India, was targeting someone who's involved in a key element of the Israeli-Indian relationship. Regarding Georgia, I think it was simply a convenient location, a place where perhaps such an attack could be put together in a relatively easy way, you know, getting beyond security measures.
So, presuming that the Israelis are right and there is a pattern that is based on the motives that they have outlined, why places so far from Israel itself? Why strike out in that manner?
Well, I think there has been a pattern in the past that there have been attacks abroad that have been attributed, for example, to Hezbollah backed by Iran. And this battle is often waged abroad because it's much tougher, of course, to get at targets inside Israel or even areas that Israel controls. And so I think the people trying to attack the Israelis are looking for soft spots, you know, areas where they can penetrate security measures where they're less stringent than they would be perhaps in Israel, in Western Europe, in the United States, etc.
Is there any third party that might conceivably be responsible for these near simultaneous explosions that occurred in Tbilisi and in New Delhi?
Well, it's hard to point to any other element that would be interested in such a strike. Analysts of all persuasions here, really, regardless of whether they're more with the government or against the government, have concluded that there really can't be any other source but something emanating from Iran or an Iranian-supported organization, because it seems that that would be the only group that would have an interest in carrying out such attacks.
Apparently, widespread protests are planned against the Iranian government in Iran by Iranians tomorrow. So another suspicion has been that there might be an effort to somehow divert attention from that. It's the Green Movement that is behind that. In the meantime, obviously, or I would assume that these incidents will raise tensions and are raising tensions that are already pretty high.
Well, Iran and Israel have been involved in a war of words over Iran's nuclear program, and that escalating rhetoric has gotten even more heated in recent weeks. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak has been ringing the alarm bell and saying that soon the Iranian nuclear program will be unreachable, will enter what he calls an immunity zone where it won't be able to be damaged with all the facilities underground. And so there's been a new sense of urgency in the whole exchange over Iran's nuclear program. So these bombings come against the backdrop of that and certainly are going to play into this and add a new twist to the escalating confrontation here.
Joel Greenberg, a Jerusalem correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks, as always, for being on our program.
Thank you.
Today's program produced by Francis Anderton with Christian Bordahl and Katie Cooper. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point. Produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.